uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to West Virginia, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, Live 365's American FM, WhiteRoseSociety.org, in 29 states on CRN Digital and cable systems. Welcome back to our program. For your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, it's the end of the week, the time when we traditionally sit down with Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives, the congressman from Vermont. He's been reelected 7 times, longest-serving independent member in the history of the House of Representatives. Neither Democrat nor Republican, a guy that you can expect to get the straight story from. Congressman Sanders, his website, Bernie.org, if you want more information, www.Bernie.org. Our telephone number, if you'd like to call in and speak with Congressman Sanders, is 866-889-8894, toll-free across the United States, 866-889-8894. And, of course, the website, if you want to drop into our live chat room, is tomhartman.com. Click the live chat button, and it'll just drop you right in there. Hey, Bernie.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I am great. So glad to have you on, and happy Friday to you. Great weekend. You had a victory in Congress this week.
We did. We had a real major victory on an issue that is concerning millions and millions of Americans. That is the USA Patriot Act. The other day, we were able to bring forth an amendment that won by 51 votes. It had every Democrat except one. It had 39 Republicans on board as well. And that said that we should take out libraries and bookstores from Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act, so that when people walk into a library or a bookstore, they don't have to worry that their reading records are being monitored by the FBI.
Now, how did you pull this off in defiance of Denny Hastert and Tom DeLay, the House leadership, who were both totally opposed to this?
And President George W. Bush as well. It took a lot of work. And I want to say this. I voted against the USA Patriot Act when it first came up, because while I didn't know everything about it at the time, I knew enough to know that this was a real attack on civil liberties. And what I believed then and what I believe now, and it's important to reiterate this, terrorism is, in fact, a serious issue. And I think the United States government has got to do everything that it can to protect the American people from another terrorist attack. But the challenge here that I believe we can meet is that we can protect the people from terrorism without undermining the constitutional rights that make us a free country. We don't have to toss the Constitution into the garbage can to protect the American people. And that's what the fight is about. What happened is that a couple of years ago, a group of librarians from the state of Vermont contacted me, and they said, do you know that Section 215 of the Patriot essentially allows the FBI to go to a secret, what we call a FISA court, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, and then the judge has no option. But if the FBI is saying that they're doing an investigation on terrorism, and obviously they do a lot of that, the judge has no choice but to give them an order which will allow them to go into a library and go into a bookstore and get the reading records of the person that they are investigating. The problem here is the FBI does not have to show probable cause. They don't have to tell this judge or convince the judge that there is a particular reason why they are investigating this person. Is it a letter to the editor that somebody wrote critical of the president? Is that a reason to investigate anybody? Most of us think not. So what we want to do is say, sure, if the FBI believes that somebody is a terrorist and they're using a library or bookstore, I want them to be able to go into that library and bookstore. They always have had the right, and they should have the right, because we want to protect the American people. But there has to be a certain foundation, a certain probable cause by which they make the case. And if they make the case, then they should be able to go in. But they should not have a blank check. Furthermore, in terms of this provision, if the FBI visits a librarian and says, okay, we have an order, give us the name, the books that, you know, this particular person is taking out, the librarian can't tell anybody. If the librarian tells anybody, she is in violation of the law and can get into trouble. Needless to say, the person being investigated doesn't know about it as well, cannot defend himself or herself. So what we saw yesterday, I think, is every Democrat except one and 39 Republicans standing up and say, wait a second, yeah, we're going to defend the American people from terrorism, but we don't want to create the kind of fear, climate of fear in America where people are going to be afraid of taking out a book in the library because somebody may think they're a terrorist if they're reading a particular book.
That's terrorism itself.
It is. It is. And it's creating...
It's terrorizing the people of America.
Yeah, that's right. But freedom, you know, the president talks, every time the president gives a speech, he uses the word freedom a million times. He wants freedom all over the world, freedom in America. What does freedom mean? Freedom, you know, is a pretty subtle thing when you get to think about it. It means not being afraid to read what you want to read. It means not being afraid to say what you want to say, to sign a petition, to express your point of view. And let me tell you, a lot of people are afraid. And this kind of stuff and this kind of legislation, the Patriot Act, in many ways, just makes us more afraid. Gee, if I read a biography about this person, is somebody going to think I'm a terrorist? Well, I don't want to read that. I'm not going to ask this question. I'm not going to write this letter to the editor. Well, that's not what America is supposed to be about. In America, what we pride ourselves on about is, hey, I may disagree with you, you disagree with me, but what we both agree on, what people agree on, is that in America we express our point of view. We argue. We argue about the issues. We're not afraid to express our point of view. And it's, you know, provisions like the USA, provisions within the USA Patriot Act, I'm afraid, make us a more fearful country, and that's not good.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's not healthy for democracy. Now, at the same time that you just had this major victory over the House leadership and the Republican leadership and George Bush, who is still threatening to veto this thing if it gets to his desk, which would make it the first veto that he's ever exercised in as president. But in any case, at the same time you had this victory, my understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the administration is pushing to take courts out of the process altogether. I mean, with the libraries here, at least the FBI had to go to a FISA court, even though the judge was essentially a rubber stamp. At least there was a judge. And what they're saying now is we should be able to snoop in people's homes. We should be able to tap their phones. We should be able to watch what they're looking at on the Internet. We should be able to invade their personal papers and possessions, to paraphrase the Fourth Amendment, without having any judge involved at all. Is that...
Well, this is what's happening. As many of the listeners know, the Patriot Act was passed 6 weeks after 9/11. Clearly, America was in a traumatic moment. Many people afraid. It passed without the hearings that should have taken place. And I think the truth is that most members of Congress will tell you they really didn't. They weren't all that familiar with all aspects of the bill that they overwhelmingly voted for. Now, what's happened in the intervening years is the American people in large numbers, seven states, by the way, have spoken out, including my state of Vermont, have spoken out and said, we have concerns about the Patriot Act. 379 communities have gone on record saying, we have concerns about the Patriot Act. Many members of Congress are now saying, gee, you know, we didn't know what was in it. We have concerns. That's the good news. The bad news is that the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is handling the bill, the reauthorization process in the Senate, met behind closed doors, not a great way to deal with the issue. And in fact, instead of beginning the process of maybe going over some of those sunsetted provisions and making them more friendly to freedom and civil liberties, in fact expanded them. And I think that's the point that you're making. So what we're doing is making a bad situation even worse. Now, there's a long way to go in the process, so I don't want to tell anybody or suggest anybody that the game is over by any means. And the victory that we won the other day has put the House on record at saying we would at least want some changes in the USA Patriot Act. But your point is well taken. There are other provisions. They're dealing with the Fourth Amendment, the ability of the FBI to walk into your house and get information without your knowledge and so forth and so on. The key issue, and it's just what you said, is judicial oversight. What America is about, what our system of justice is about, is we don't give law enforcement agencies the right to say, hey, you, come on over here. I don't like you. You're under arrest. What's the reason, officer? There is no reason. I've just taken you away. That's not what, obviously, freedom is about and a democratic society is about. There has to be a reason. And that reason is we have a constitution which gives the people certain protections. We have laws that give people certain protections. And the struggle right now is to make sure that the Constitution is obeyed and that people's rights are not denied and that there is that body called the judiciary which oversees this thing.
Right. And that said, Bernie, is speaking about, you know, we're, George Bush says we're fighting in Iraq to protect our freedoms. We have on the line actually a captain in the National Guard who is calling us from Iraq at this moment.
Wow.
Let's take that call right now, if that's all right with you. He says to call him Buddha. Hey, Buddha.
Good morning, Tom. Good morning, Congressman Sanders. I heard you on Young Turks yesterday, and I asked the Turks, in fact, if they would pass my regards and congratulations on to you, but they didn't, those bums.
Thank you.
Anyway, Congressman Sanders, again, congratulations on this small step toward reclaiming our civil liberties. Are there not other provisions in the Patriot Act that give them the right to go after other records other than library and bookstore records, but also medical records, driver's licenses, that sort of thing?
Yes, they're all.
Okay, and I'm beginning to understand the National Rifle Association over all these years, how they fight, you know, even tooth and nail against the assault weapons stands and that sort of thing, because you give them just a little bit, and then they just start taking and taking. And, you know, all I want to say is just keep up the good fight. Civil liberties are everything, and that is what defines America. And I certainly appreciate your efforts.
Well, thank you very much, and we hope you come home as soon as possible in good health.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Safely. Yeah, good luck there. So this is really what America's all about, Bernie, what you're fighting for. And how can the administration claim otherwise? I don't get it.
Well, what they do is, look, 9/11 was a frightening day in American history. 3,000 innocent people died. There are people out there, Tom, who you know and I know, you know, are prepared to kill Americans and blow up buildings. We saw that in Oklahoma and so forth and so on. And people are frightened. And the question is, what concerns me very much is that the president is essentially saying, look, these are scary times, and we're going to have – we'll protect you. Don't worry about it. We'll protect you. But the price of protecting you is giving up so many of the rights that men and women have fought and died for. And I just think that is a terrible thing. And, you know, some of the Republicans who got on the floor and spoke for me in support of this amendment the other day made the point even more strongly than I did. You want security. You know what was a very secure country? Saddam Hussein's Iraq was a very secure country.
Right.
Communist,
yeah.
Russia was a very, very...
Very little crime. You know,
very little
very
crime.
Little
you got
crime.
Out of line, they threw you in a concentration camp, they shot you. That's a good way to control crime.
Yeah.
You know? But obviously that is not what the American people want. The real challenge is, I mean, protecting our people against terrorism is serious business. We can do it, but we can remain a free country in the process, and that's what this struggle is about.
The eternal dynamic tension that our founders struggled with in putting together this brilliant document, the Constitution, that you're working so hard to defend.
That's right.
Congressman Bernie Sanders, our toll-free number, 1-866-889-8894. We'll be right back after this with your questions for Congressman Sanders. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Here in the real free speech zone, no barbed wire, no RNC passes required. You can speak your mind. Our toll-free number, 1-866-889-8894. It's our regular Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Live from, I believe he's in Washington, D.C. today, or perhaps in Vermont. Where are you, Bernie?
No, I'm in Washington.
You're in Washington,
D.C. The House is in session today.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And Bill in Cleveland, Ohio on the line. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Representative Sanders, soon to
Hi,
be
Bill.
Senator. Hey, I'd like to talk just for a second about troop withdrawal, gradual troop withdrawal, to be realistic, from Iraq. And the thing of it is, I thought of an analogy this morning about, you know, how they like to say that, you know, well, we can't set a date because it'll embolden the insurgents. Well, you know, they don't need a hell of a lot more emboldening at this point. But on the other hand, last year, you know, they set a date for turning the government over to Iraq. And you know, they were able to do it. And as a matter of fact, they did it 2 days early. So what I'm thinking is, you know, why not set a date for 2000 and let's say, 7 and pull them out halfway through 2006? It just seems to me that when this country is determined to do something, they find a way to do it.
Well, I think Bill makes a good point. The concern there, without even getting into the point that Tom raised earlier about the president's dishonesty in terms of how he got in there in the first place, weapons of mass destruction and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, that was actually on a different program, but
right.
In any case, yeah.
Right, I mean, but this is a point that people have been making for a long time. The issue now is what do we do right now? My concern is that this president, after some 1,700 Americans have been killed there, 12,000 have been wounded, tens of thousands of Iraqis have been killed, $300 billion has been spent, there is no exit strategy. When is enough enough? And I'm reminded of a senator from the state of Vermont who served a number of years ago, Senator George Aiken. In the middle of the Vietnam War, he said, you know, it's time to declare victory and start bringing our troops back home. And I think that applies to where we are right now. I oppose the war. I help lead the opposition, giving the president the authority to go to war. But where we are right now is, can we bring the troops home tomorrow? No, we can't. Saddam Hussein is in jail. That's a good thing. The Iraqi people have a lot more freedom, self-independence. That's a good thing. But I don't want to see this debate continue 5 years from now, 10 years from now, more and more people are dead. I think it is appropriate that the United States government continue to support the Iraqi military and the Iraqi government with the money that they need and so forth. But I think it is time to begin withdrawing our troops. And I think, you know, Bill is right. We should. I don't think you can do that overnight, but I think we can begin the process.
You know, Bernie, Richard Nixon ran successfully twice for president on having a secret plan to end the war in Vietnam. And now we know from the Nixon White House tapes that it was just, you know, something they cooked up. I mean, there was no plan. But I'm starting to hear on the talk shows and things from the Republicans that there's a secret plan to get us out of Iraq. Are we seeing history repeat itself here?
I'm not aware of that. I mean, certainly the president has not been, you know, what we are demanding, what some of us are demanding now in the Congress is, Mr. President, in fact, give us a plan. What is your exit strategy? When do we begin bringing our troops home? We have enormous problems facing the American people. I mean, it's, the loss of life is terrible.
But what if the answer is never? I mean, we're building 17 huge bases there. We're building an embassy that's going to cost.
Well, if the answer is never, I think you're not going to find the Republicans continuing to control the United States government, because I think the people of this country want an answer every day. Every poll that comes out, people are saying, hey, what's going on? You know, the number of people who support the effort, the way the president is conducting the effort in Iraq, is going down, down, and down. If the Republicans want to stick to this, they are not going to be the government terribly much longer.
Yeah, and that may well be the case. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. From outside the United States, 503-248-0620. 866-889-8894. If you'd like to talk to Congressman Bernie Sanders, we have the lines are lighting up, and we will be back with your calls right after this. This is the Tom Hartman radio program, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Well, or at least we'd like to have a voice in things. We'll be back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Let's get it started. Let's get it started in here.
Okay, let's get it started. Welcome back. It's Tom Hartman here with you with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number if you'd like to be on. David in Asheville, North Carolina on the line. Hey, David.
Hey, it's an honor and a pleasure to speak with you both today. I'm concerned about Bush's personal exit strategy right now. I was just brought to my attention House Joint Resolution 24, which proposes repealing the 22nd Amendment. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, trying to repeal term limits.
Yeah, the 22nd Amendment being that the president can only run for two terms in office.
Exactly. This feels like it's...
Sensenbrenner just introduced this, didn't he, Bernie?
I think that's right. Needless to say, I oppose that. I think that two terms for one president is fine. Sometimes amendments are offered which are not going to go anyplace. I don't think that that is going to go anyplace. Another piece of legislation, by the way, which does frighten me even more, is some Republican bills coming down which would do away with some of the best aspects of the Feingold campaign finance laws, limiting the amount of money that wealthy individuals can spend. Clearly, the great crisis facing politics in America is the degree to which big money controls the political process, and we see legislation after legislation being passed, which is paid for by banks or insurance companies or the energy industry, and we want to make sure that as bad as the situation is today, we don't make it even worse. But I don't see imminent passage of an amendment to do away with the term limits regarding president.
Well said. Bob in Bennington, Vermont on the line. Hey, Bob, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Hey, Congressman.
Hi.
I'm in exact agreement that one of the things that should happen is we should repeal the Patriot Act. It takes away too many of our freedoms.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Vietnam veteran. I am absolutely opposed to giving up any of my freedoms to the government. I have to fly to Chicago tomorrow morning. And one of the things that happens when I board that aircraft is I have to give up my right to illegal search and seizure to get on an airplane. That's bizarre.
Well, Bob, I believe me, I hear what you're saying. I think there will have to be some compromises. I think I get on a plane quite often. I'll be on a plane this evening. I have to go through the same process. On the other hand, I don't want somebody going on a plane who has a gun who's going to, you know, take that plane and hijack it. But I think clearly what Congress has done is given up too many of our rights, and this administration has been much too aggressive in wanting the government to have powers which they don't need, essentially, to fight terrorism. So I think we have to draw a balance, but I think this White House has gone way over the edge.
And the Republicans in Congress as well. Larry in Grand Rapids, if I may add. Larry in Grand Rapids is live with us. Hey, Larry.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Congressman Sanders.
Hi, Larry.
Two quick things, and you can address them both. One is, I think this thing about the permanent bases being built in Iraq suggests that we will never have an exit strategy. And two, the other thing is, are you aware of a Department of Defense memo dated June 29th of 2000 granting Brown and Root contracts to build concentration camps in Guantanamo? That's a year and a half before 9/11.
No, actually, I'm not. I have to tell you. I'm sorry. I'm not familiar with that.
Larry, thanks for the call. We'll have to check.
I mean, I think we're concerned, obviously, about what is going on in Guantanamo, what kind of image that is spreading throughout the world. Obviously, we've got to clean that up, but I'm not familiar with what Larry is saying.
Okay. Mike in Elyria. How do you pronounce that, Mike? Ohio?
Very good. How are you?
It's Elyria, right?
Elyria, right.
Okay. What's up?
A couple comments. I know you're playing Steppenwolf.
Yeah.
On the intro, you guys ever play Monster?
I don't know. I don't do the bumper music here.
You ought to listen to it.
Okay.
I mean, it really comes into effect of what's going on in America. And number two, I was listening to one of the cable channels, and they said the RNC has this secret thing or that they're doing behind-the-scenes things where if someone buys Coors Light or something at a bar and they know where it is, they're going to target their voting registrations and stuff to that.
No, what they're doing, Mike, is, you know, you can make a good guess. Of course, no one is ever 100% right. But if you can check somebody's purchasing habits, somebody buys a big yacht, for example, for a whole lot of money.
Right.
You can make a reasonable guess that that person is likely to vote Republican, right? So if you have that information, you contact that person, you hit them up for money, or you try to get their vote. You target that person. And there are certain products that people buy who are more likely to vote one way or the other, and that's what they are doing, which is an interesting political approach.
Yeah. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 866-889-8894. Outside the United States, 503-248-0620. Lynn in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Lynn.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I guess I agree with a couple of callers back, and my comment was basically, I keep hearing people say, well, we have to give up a few freedoms to have security, and I keep saying, I don't want to give up any. I don't think we have to give up our freedoms to do this. We could have treated this as a police, you know, a crime and not given up any rights.
Well, I mean, the problem there, Lynn, is would you feel comfortable going on an airplane without any inspection at all?
Well, no, but I'm not sure that's the kind of rights I'm talking about.
Oh, okay. All right.
I mean, I think we have to, I mean, that's a safety issue, right?
Yes, I think so, right. Yeah, I understand what you're saying. And the issue is, I believe, good law enforcement, adequately trained, adequately funded, we can effectively protect the American people. Terrorism is very difficult to fight against. I think we can do it. I think we do not have to surrender our constitutional rights. And that's really what this struggle is about regarding the USA Patriot Act and other pieces of legislation.
1-866-889-8894, toll free. David in Georgia on the line. Hey, David, welcome.
Hi, Bernie?
Yes.
Yes, I hope that we can call you Senator Sanders pretty soon.
Thank you.
I'm very concerned about our voting patterns. We had talked about Iraq and their voting arena. However, we are having a real issue, particularly in the South here, and I joined as an auditor for some of these voting districts, but we're having a real problem getting feedback and verifying votes or being counted correctly. Is there any legislation or anything? And why are the Republicans so steadfast against us monitoring and getting some type of paper trail or receipt?
Well, David, you're right. I mean, this is an issue I know that Tom has talked about a whole lot on the show, CERN all over this country. And I don't know how anybody with a straight face can argue against the point that you're making. When people cast the ballot in the United States of America, they have every right to believe and expect that vote is going to be accurately counted. At the very least, you want to have a paper trail. What is the argument against that? Who presumably is against a fair counting of the ballot?
Well,
I don't know.
Apparently the House leadership is against it.
Well, there is some legislation here. Rush Holt of New Jersey has a bill which will provide a paper trail for touchscreen voting. I'm on it. There's a lot of support for it. I am not going to tell you that it's going to pass. A number of states are moving forward in the area. But David raises a good issue that I hope that people will fight at the local level, at the state level, to make absolutely certain that every vote cast is accurately counted, and the people know that.
Yeah, well done. Norm in Cleveland, Ohio, on the line. Hey, Norm, welcome to the program. You're live with Congressman Sanders.
Hi. First of all, Tom, welcome to Ohio.
Oh, thank you. You must be listening on Radio Free Ohio.
I am.
Great.
The one that they won't even say the name of the station because it begins with W.
Yeah, there you go. We are so pleased to be on that affiliate. Yep.
Yes. Well, two things. First, this guy from Jersey who wants talk about the touch screens. Jersey still uses paper ballots, and I wish the country would go back to that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my question is a procedural question. What is there a way that in the Senate that a vote could be a secret vote? Because I've heard it said that senators left to their own devices would vote against Bolton. Now, is there a procedural way that this can be a secret ballot?
Not that I know of. I'm not an expert on Senate rules here, but I suspect these are open.
Okay. Well, it's so great to hear you. This is such a breath of fresh air, and thank you.
Thank you, Norm.
Thanks a lot, Norm. Great to hear from you, too. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line, and I'll be in Grand Rapids, by the way, 1 week from today, broadcasting live from the Celebration Cinema, WTKG, and we're going to have a little gig afterwards, I believe. We're working out the details on that, and it's going to be a lot of fun, and everybody's welcome to come down and say hi. Rick, welcome to the program.
Yes, and I hope you have a good time in Grand Rapids.
I'm sure I will.
And, Bernie, I hope you're in the Senate soon.
Thanks very much, Rick.
And I wanted to congratulate you on this victory on the Patriot Act. Our Congressman Ehlers here, his daughter is a librarian, and apparently he talked to her about this, and she must have convinced him.
Yes, Vern voted with us. Yes, that's right.
Also, some other things I noticed this week, there were the Conyers hearings.
Yep.
There was that bipartisan business with, the guy who came up with the Freedom Fries. which was a stupid idea. But
Jones from North Carolina.
But he and Ron Paul and Abercrombie and Kucinich.
Yes, that's correct.
And also, even Alan Greenspan was saying that the disparity in wealth between the rich and the poor in this country is so bad now, it's getting so bad that it actually endangers the capitalist system, which, of course, I think that's a good thing. But am I wrong to think that these little incidents taken by themselves are no big deal, but taken all together, is the tide turning ever so slightly?
Rick, I think that's a very good point, and exactly right. I think you're very perceptive to pick up on all of these points. Walter Jones from North Carolina, I know Walter fairly well. He's a very, very conservative guy, a decent guy, an honest guy. And he has turned against the war because he believed he was lied to. And he supported the war based on the evidence that was given to him, and now he has concluded that he was lied to, and he is an honorable guy, and he said, hey, that's wrong. So I think you are seeing sentiment in the Congress now demanding that the president provide us with an exit strategy. What you're seeing in terms of the poverty issue, not only Greenspan, but you're seeing many of the newspapers now that had ignored the issue of poverty for many years beginning to talk about the reality that the United States has by far the largest gap between the rich and the poor, that poverty is increasing. That's being discussed. And this nonsense that the Bush administration keeps talking about how our economy is booming and so forth and so on is, I think, being exploded day after day because the middle class, in fact, is shrinking. And the only people who are doing really well are the people on top. So I think Rick's point is right. I think the polls indicate it. I think you're seeing that sentiment in Congress right now, whether it's the economy, whether it's the war in Iraq, whether it's the issue of civil liberties. More and more people are saying, hey, wait a second, what's going on in this country is not right. We can do a lot better.
I'm just astounded that there's not more coverage in the newspapers, Bernie, about the fact that there are 24,000 fewer jobs right now than there were the day George Bush took office.
Well, in the private sector.
Right.
You're right. In fact, we had a debate last week on trade. I offered an amendment. And that was the point that I made. The Republicans can go forward with a straight face and talk about how the economy is doing well when there are fewer private sector jobs today than there were when George Bush first came in. Do you know where the new jobs are? They're with the government.
Right.
That's where they are.
Right. Department of Homeland Security, TSA, and helping, you know, contractors in Iraq.
So, you know, the idea that this economy is doing well when real wages are in decline, when we're losing millions of good-paying jobs because of our disastrous trade policies with China and other developing countries, when most of the new jobs being created are Walmart-type jobs, low pay, minimal benefits. This economy is not doing well for the middle class. Yeah, it is doing well for the very, very rich Bush's supporters, but not for ordinary people.
Yeah. Margaret in Asheville, North Carolina on the line. Welcome, Margaret.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. And I've already started calling you Senator Sanders, and I will be sending you support. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Margaret. We've got a long way to go against very strong Republican opposition, but thanks for your support.
I know we do. Well, the majority of people of us in this country have a long way to go to change this horror story that's happening in our country. And thank you for the extraordinarily excellent fight about the Patriot Act and our civil liberties. I'm abhorrent of. I've read a great deal of it, and it's just horrible. But I have a question about this. You've passed the amendment, and since 2000, I've been watching C-SPAN, and I follow all this. And I'm wondering, because I see so often that, in fact, even though you all, we have amendments in both Senate and House that get passed, when these things go into committee, they take them out.
Yes.
How can they do that when you've had a vote?
Margaret, you're asking an excellent question, and I must tell you that when I first came to Congress in 1991, I had the same expression of shock that you had. I remember something when I first came. I think it dealt with Head Start. And in the House, we increased money for the Head Start program. In the Senate, they increased money for the Head Start program. And you know what happened? That thing never went into effect. The truth of the matter is that most people don't know it. Most people say, okay, you do something in the House, you do something in the Senate, they work it out, and they'll come somewhere toward a middle ground, right?
Yeah.
Wrong.
Theoretically.
Wrong. What actually happens is the conference committee can do anything it wants. In fact, the conference committee can completely rewrite the legislation.
Well, they did that with the Patriot Act, if I understand that right. The one that you all actually voted on was not what went to committee.
It was not the one that came out of the House, which was a much better bill that came out of the Senate. That's correct. So when you see the House and Senate getting together, what ends up happening is a small number of people, and in this case, it'll be the Republican leadership telling those people what to do. So in one sense, it's not unimportant what happens on the House floor or the Senate floor. That's important. But there's a whole other reality that takes place quietly within a conference room, which is dictated by the leadership of the Republican Party. So I know you have a right to be shocked, but that is the way things happen.
And another important reason to get back to the adversarial system of at least, you know, two different parties controlling two different branches of government in some way.
Right.
Because we have just this monolithic Republican control. It's a little spooky, if I may say so. 10 minutes before the hour, 866-889-8894. Our telephone number, it's Brunch with Bernie. Congressman Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org. We'll be right back.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. So I'm taking my country back.
Yeah, it's time to take our country back. Welcome back, Tom. Back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, along with Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment, and James in San Antonio, Texas, on the line with us. Hey, James, welcome. You're live with Congressman Sanders.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. Congressman, congratulations on your victory this week. And what I wanted to talk to you all about is there's a news report on ABC today that Governor Jeb Bush there in Florida wants to start a state investigation on why Terri Schiavo went into the vegetative state she went into and ultimately spent 15 years that way. And I don't know why, what's with this family, that they don't let these issues rest. You know, he's not her father. I mean, he's not a family member.
But he wants to run for president in 6 years.
Well, I hope this is a nail in that coffin.
James, you ask a very good question, and I'll give you my answer. You see, these guys have nothing to say about health care. I'm sure that everybody in Florida has good quality health care. I'm sure that everybody in Florida has good paying jobs. I'm sure in Florida there are no environmental problems. I'm sure in Florida all of the middle class can send their kids to good colleges. So not having any problems like that, I guess he has the time to worry about the Terri Schiavo family. But really what they are trying to do, of course, is deflect attention away from the issues that they have nothing to say about. They represent the wealthy and the powerful. They could care less about the middle class and working families. So the only way they stay in power is by dealing with these wedge issues, coming up with conspiracy theories or whatnot. But what a waste of government time and energy when the state of Florida has so many other problems. It is beyond comprehension.
And yeah, and well said. We've run out of time here. We've got about 6 seconds. Bernie, I'll let you wrap up the show here. Your message to our listeners?
Well, we got to keep fighting, and I think we are turning the tide. The American people are catching on that this government represents the wealthy and the powerful and ignores the rest of us. So let's keep pushing.
And it needs to be at the grassroots level. We need to get involved.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Congressman Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org on the Internet. For more information about Congressman Sanders, I consider you America's congressman, the only independent member of the House of Representatives. Thanks so much for being with us today, Bernie.
See you next week.
We'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Indeed. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. You are right smack dab in the middle of the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations. Well, what, left? Liberals? I just find it amazing that the folks in the mainstream media, they say, well, this guy's a liberal. Well, how do you know he's a liberal? Well, he's a liberal because he's in favor of a clean environment. Well, I think most Americans are in favor of a clean environment. Isn't that mainstream? Well, he's a liberal because he's in favor of good public education. Well, aren't most Americans in favor of public education? Well, he's a liberal because he thinks there should be free education for college students. I would suggest to you that most Americans would support, you know, going back to the kind of program that Thomas Jefferson created when he created the University of Virginia to have free education so that for college students, as virtually every country in Europe does, which, by the way, is one of the reasons why they're starting to trounce us in terms of intellectual property, you know, patents and the professions. And they're actually more socially mobile than we are. It's easier to break out of the lower economic classes into the middle class in Europe today than it is in the United States for the first time in history. Well, with the exception of the late 1920s. We're back there. We're back there in the Gilded Age. So it's just, well, he's a liberal because he's in favor of Social Security. I think most Americans are in favor of Social Security. He's a liberal because he's in favor of a decent minimum wage. Well, actually, you look at the facts. Every time the minimum wage is increased, immediately, the years thereafter, inflation goes down, the number of jobs goes up. Now, the cons would say, well, we raise the minimum wage, and that means that employers have to pay people more, so they're going to lay people off. In fact, if you look at the history of the minimum wage, that's never what happens. What happens is you increase the minimum wage, and people have more money in their pockets. People working at the minimum wage spend 100% of their income. It's not like tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires like Bush does with trickle-down economics. You give tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires, and they don't spend all of that money. They've got what they need. They invest it. They save it. They stash it away someplace. Or if they are going to build a factory, are they going to build a factory in Ohio, or are they going to build a factory in China? And, you know, history pretty clearly shows here we've had three huge tax cuts that have generated $4 trillion in debt that our grandchildren and children and great-grandchildren are going to have to pay off so that Bush could give millionaires and billionaires tax cuts, and we have 24,000 fewer private sector jobs today than we did the day that George Bush took office. Now, you tell me that trickle-down economics works. I don't buy it. In fact, the last time the minimum wage was increased in the mid-1990s, 11 million jobs were created as a result of it. Because when you increase the minimum wage, you put money in people's pockets. At the bottom of the wage scale, those people spend all that money. That spending of that money creates an immediate economic stimulus. It generates more demand in the marketplace. That demand in the marketplace causes employers to say, hey, people want more of our goods. We need to hire some extra people to make them. It's very simple. It's how economics has worked forever, until Ronald Reagan came along and Lafler sat down over lunch with him and said, let me show you the Lafler curve here. And just kind of made this thing up. It was George Herbert Walker Bush correctly called it voodoo economics. And we can see what it's done to us. In 1980, when Reagan came into office, a quarter of America was unionized. Half of American workers, half of the American workforce, of the 100 million more or less American people in the American workforce, half of them had jobs where they had a retirement, they had a pension, they had fully paid health insurance, they were able to put their kids through college, they could buy homes, they owned homes, and they could take vacations, they had sick pay. Half of America. Because 25% were unionized, and that sets the floor. Now, Reagan comes in 1980, declares war on the working people, declares war on organized labor, busts up PATCO in 1981, and starts taking apart the Labor Department and turning it into what it is today, the anti-labor department. I mean, it literally is. And now we're down to about 8% of the private workforce being unionized. About 15% of Americans have those kinds of jobs. This is the absolute predictable result of Reaganomics, Bushonomics, trickle-down economics, and I would even say to some extent Clintonomics,
because Bill Clinton signed NAFTA and GATT and bought into a lot of this economic, conservative economic political voodoo theory. Not all of it. You know, to his credit, Bill Clinton didn't completely go over to the dark side, but he got awful close to it. And so, you know, it's fairly pretty. So anyhow, how can you, I'm a liberal. You know, I will tell you, I consider myself a progressive. I consider myself a liberal, however you want to define that, because I'm in favor of these things. I'm in favor of there being a middle class. I think it's a good thing. I believe it's important for democracy. But anyhow, so I say it's the radical middle, because I think that where the place where I'm standing politically and the things that I'm talking about are the things that the majority of Americans want. We would like our civil liberties, thank you very much. We would like to be prosecuting criminals rather than declaring wars against countries that have not threatened us. You know, they say, oh, we're over in Iraq to stop the terrorists before they come here. Nonsense! There were no terrorists in Iraq before we got there. Maybe one, but certainly not thousands. What the people that Bush is calling terrorists are nationalists. They're saying that they want their country back. I heard somebody on TV the other day say, well, if we left Iraq, where would all those terrorists go? They might go someplace else. No, they'd go, give them a job, they go back to work. It would be the same situation as in the United States. The British were looking at us, hey, look at those terrorist Americans. They want to have their own country. They don't like us occupying them. And they're shooting from behind trees. Those are non-traditional military techniques. You know, King George III calling George Washington a terrorist. And what happened after the war? We went back to work. It happens all over the world. Nations get their independence. The British, the Indians, I mean, as in India, the Indians in India, terrorists against the British. The British left, they went back to work. So, I mean, it's just, this is not rocket science. So in number one, the Bush nonsense. But on the other hand, I would very much like to see the Bush administration doing what Clinton did with the Oklahoma City bombing. I mean, this was just made common sense, right? You've got somebody who is a criminal, somebody who has committed a crime, broken the law, murdered people. You track them down. You use the criminal justice system. You give them a trial before a jury of their peers, and you sentence them to whatever punishment is appropriate. And the folks in Oklahoma City have closure today because Tim McVeigh got arrested and was put to death. I mean, end of discussion. But Osama bin Laden? I mean, it was criminals who came after us, and it was a fairly small number of them. The best estimates of the CIA in 2000, 2001 were that there might be 25,000 people affiliated with Al-Qaeda. That's not a lot of people to be in a criminal organization. There's probably that many people in the mafia in the United States. And on 9/11, we had the entire world with us. They were all with us. Le Monde, the French newspaper, its headline, we are all Americans now. It's candlelight vigils in Tehran, Iran, in solidarity with the United States on the day after 9/11. And if George Bush had done the same thing that Bill Clinton did after the Oklahoma City bombing, which you will recall we initially thought was probably Muslim terrorists, if George Bush had done the same thing that Bill Clinton did, which is to go on TV and say, these guys are criminals, they are nuts, they are not part of our society, they don't represent any legitimate religion, we all consider them outcasts and pariahs, and we are going to hunt them down. We want the help of Interpol, we want the help of police departments from other communities, from towns, from counties, from states, from other countries. And we are going to find these terrorists and bring them to justice. And Bill Clinton did that with the Oklahoma City bombing, and it worked. It worked. And if George Bush had done that, we would have 1,700 people who would still be alive today. Not to mention the ones who have died in Afghanistan as well. We would have tens of thousands of Americans who would have arms and legs and eyes and ears still intact. 100,000 Iraqis would not be dead. Iraq would not be a devastated landscape. Afghanistan wouldn't have become the largest narco state in the world. And we might have had closure. You'll recall the Taliban offered to give us Osama bin Laden. And George Bush turned him down. He turned them down because they said, we won't give him to you, America. We'll give him to a third country where he'll get a fair trial. If the guy really was a criminal, and again, he had a real trial. Because, yeah, they were kind of over it with him, too. And he had a real trial. This is how it should be conducted. Instead, Bush comes up with this whole brand new category.
Terrorists, enemy combatants. They're not
prisoners of war. And they're not criminals. What are they? So Alberto Gonzalez invents a whole new category. Enemy combatants. He just pulled it out of thin air. It has no legal basis. And we've built now 5 concentration camps down in Guantanamo Bay to hold these people with no due process. And the rest of the world that was ready to be by our side to hunt down the terrorists and find them and bring them to justice. And believe you me, they would have. We had Muslim countries saying, we want to help you find these people and bring them to justice. And they would have. And instead, Bush had to show that his daddy was a wimp. He had to go into Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11 anyway. Yesterday at John Conyers' hearings, This is just absolutely remarkable. I want to play a clip after this next break of Cindy Sheehan, who was, we played a clip of her on the program yesterday. I interviewed her yesterday morning. She's the founder of Gold Star Families for Peace. Their website, gsfp.org. And she testified before the Conyers Commission hearings, or the forum, I guess they're calling it, yesterday in the Capitol. It's amazing to me how little publicity this thing is getting. The mainstream media, what they're all saying is, oh, this is old news. We all knew that George always wanted to go after Iraq. What they're completely forgetting is that for a 2-year period, George Bush was saying that we weren't going to go after Iraq. He was saying things like,
you said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Yeah, and a lie. He had already decided to go to a war in Iraq, says the Downing Street memo. If he lied to us, if he lied to the American people and he lied to Congress, that is the definition of the high crime and misdemeanor that's worthy of impeachment. That's, after all, what they impeached Bill Clinton for. Lying about sex. Now, here you've got a guy who has lied about something that has resulted in 1,700 people dying in the United States. 1,700 Americans and 100,000 Iraqis dying. And that's not as important as somebody who lies about sex? Come on. And the mainstream media, they never talk about the fact that it's about the lie. It's not about whether or not he wanted to go to Iraq, whether there were secret plans. That's not. It's about the lies. We'll be back right after this. 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harbin. Talk radio for the rest of us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The fact is that they tell you lies. For name like oil becomes democracy.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. I just very quickly want to play for you this. Cindy Sheehan talking about how George Bush had been thinking about this for some time and why he went to war. I keep saying George Bush went to war in Iraq, lied us into a war in Iraq for political purposes. He did it because he knew that he would get political capital from having a war. He would get Republicans elected in 2002, he'd get himself reelected in 2004, and he'd be able to do things like destroy Social Security. Here is Cindy Sheehan yesterday testifying before John Conyers.
Whoop. I thought it was.
There we go.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend, Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote. It looks like George Bush was ready to lead this country into an avoidable war even before he became president.
There you go. Cindy Sheehan speaking before Congressman John Conyers Commission yesterday. Ellen Ratner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts on it, as a senior person of the State Department, in the May before we invaded, so 10 months before we invaded, I said to him, are we going to go into Iraq? He said, oh, we went after his daddy. He has to show his daddy up. Of course we are. So this is still related to his father. It's all Oedipal.
Incredible. The Oedipus complex.
The Oedipus incredible.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, so what's happening in Washington, D.C.
today? Okay, lots of things actually happening. One is the House Democratic leaders, all 13 of them, Republican leaders, have written to Pelosi, and they want Nancy Pelosi, who's the House Minority Leader, to denounce the remarks said by Dick Durbin yesterday. He said, of course, you would most certainly believe this must have been done by Nazis, Soviets, and their gulags, or some mad regime, Pol Pot or others, who that had no concern. And they basically want her to say, does the speech made by Senator Durbin also reflect your views as the House Democratic leader? If not, we respectfully request that you publicly renounce Senator Durbin's remarks.
But Senator Durbin's remark was preceded by, he said, on a couple of occasions I entered interview rooms to find a detainee chained hand and foot in the fetal position on the floor with no chair, food, or water. Most times they urinated or defecated on themselves and had been left there 24 hours or more. On one occasion, the air conditioning had been turned down so far, temperature was so cold in the room, the barefooted detainee was shaking and cold. Another time, the temperature was over 100 degrees. The detainee was unconscious on the floor with a pile of hair next to him. He'd apparently been literally pulling his hair out throughout the night. On another occasion, not only was the temperature unbearable, hot, but extremely loud rap music was being played. The detainee was chained hand and foot in the fetal position on the floor. And he went on to say, if I read this to you and did not tell you that it was an FBI agent describing what Americans had done to the prisoners in their control, you would certainly believe this had been done by Nazis, Soviets, or some mad regime like Pol Pot. I agree with him.
I agree with him 100%.
And so what's Nancy Pelosi going to do?
I've talked about it on all my little radio friends, but these people are insane.
Yeah, okay. So is Pelosi going to give in?
I hope not.
Yeah.
I don't think she will, actually.
Yeah.
I think she's just going to tell him, go take your letter and stuff it.
Yeah, okay. So, and what else is going on there?
The other thing is that White House Bulletin, which is an independent sort of news whatever, is reporting that this conservative group has put out a 10-point, it's called Progress for America, a 10-point sort of plan on how you can fight for the president's Supreme Court nominees. And this is what they're saying. Before vacancies announced, whip your membership into a frenzy with overblown rhetoric. Prepare for battle. Number two. Once the nominee is named, immediately announce the nominee's record raises more questions than it answers. They're saying that this is exactly what the Democrats are going to do. Plead for a slower pace. Anyhow, they go through this whole thing. They said liberals, Hollywood celebrities will make 11th-hour plea. Finally, official opposition is coordinated and announced in drip-drab fashion. So they're saying what the Democrats are going to do. Well, they don't know.
Well, and on the other hand, let's hope the Democrats do that.
I agree.
I have to say, because the kind of nominees that these guys have been sending up do not represent the values of mainstream America. They don't. They are right-wing extremists. Ellen, thanks so much for being with us.
Have
appreciate
a great
it.
Weekend.
Thanks, you too.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. It's never too late to start
all over again. And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, Live365's American FM, WhiteRoseSociety.org, where you can also find archives of the program. And on cable systems in 29 states on CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. It's Friday afternoon. We normally do our best of the rest of the news about this time. Get on a couple of folks who are right in the middle of it, right in the thick of it. in the news out there, in the blogosphere, in the newsosphere, as it were. And today we have with us Michael Giltz. Michael Giltz is the writer on AmericaBlog.com or AmericaBlog.org, either one will get you there, who broke the Jeff Gannon story. Hey, Michael, welcome.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here. It was our website's founder, John Aravosis, who helped break the Jeff Gannon story.
Okay, great. I stand corrected.
Along with other blogs. We want to give credit wherever it's due, of course.
There you go. And also with us, David Swanson of AfterDowningStreet.org. David Swanson, I would say instrumental in helping bring about the hearings that happened yesterday. I'm sure that John Conyers, you would say, gets more credit than you, but you certainly brought a lot of attention to this, David.
Well, John Conyers did host the hearings, and he deserves no limit of credit for what he's doing.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. So let me start with you, David, if I may. Tell us what happened yesterday at the hearing. I know that you were there. In fact, your partner in the AfterDowningStreet.org, John Boniface, who was on this program earlier in the week, testified there yesterday. In fact, I've got a little clip of his testimony that we can get to if you'd like. Tell us what happened.
Oh, well, John was brilliant, as was Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst for 27 years, as was Cindy Sheehan, whose son died in Iraq and who founded Gold Star Families for Peace, as was former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who discredited the information about Iraq building nuclear weapons and whose wife, as a consequence, was outed as a CIA analyst by the Bush administration. That was the panel, those four, and then there were about 35 Congress members who came in and out. The Republicans had scheduled an unprecedented number of votes and other important meetings during the time, not to mention relegating this to a tiny room in the basement. But it was quite impressive, and every media outlet in the country fit in there regardless. And it was 2.5 hours, and it moved steadily from we're interested in these questions to this sounds like impeachment.
Interesting. Very interesting. It's and Michael Giltz, are you, you know, out on America Blog? What's the response that folks are that you're getting to this event?
Well, we've got a link to crooksandliars.com. They have a great half-hour condensation of the hearings. I believe the hearings are also being rebroadcast on C-SPAN 3 for those with digital cable tonight at 8 p.m., but you'd have to check your listings to make sure about that. But I got to admit, it gave us a sort of a visceral thrill to hear John talking about impeachment proceedings. That's certainly the conversation we like to have people be discussing rather than something else. It was, you know, a lot of people have been following the Downing Street memos. We've got a link today to the BBC, which is crediting the bloggers in America for putting this issue into the mainstream media. And that's really, you know, what we were focused on and trying to do for the past month. We thought it was important. We thought it was something the American people needed to hear about. We couldn't believe the mainstream media wasn't covering it. And after a month of keeping this issue alive on the blog, the Washington Post and other media outlets finally picked up on it. Congressman Conyers having the hearings. It's made a big difference. It's a news story now.
Yeah, there you go. And in fact, here's John Boniface speaking yesterday before the Conyers Commission.
The recent release of the Downing Street minutes provides new and compelling evidence that the President of the United States has been actively engaged in a conspiracy to deceive and mislead the United States Congress and the American people about the basis for going to war against Iraq. If true, such conduct constitutes a high crime under Article 2, Section 4 of the United States Constitution, which states, "The President, Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors."
And David Swanson, John is not just some guy with a website. He's a constitutional lawyer, is he not?
John is a certified genius. You know, he got one of those genius grants. He is a brilliant guy. He is he's a well-known and experienced constitutional attorney and an expert on these issues. And he's one of the co-founders of AfterDowningStreet.org. And he's the movement behind this campaign. But I want to give some credit to the bloggers too. And second, what was said a moment ago. You know, it was this alliance of hundreds of bloggers that formed on its own, joined with our coalition, pushed this issue and drove it into the mainstream media, and I don't think we're beyond the point now where it's going to go on its own
without that, I think we're going to have to continue with the blogs and the websites and the progressive media outlets to keep pushing this into the mainstream media and into it in the right way.
Well, in fact, all the media I'm hearing, David, and you as well, Michael, all the mainstream media that I'm hearing is saying basically one of two things. Either A, hey, this is an old story. We already knew that George Bush wanted to go to war. Paul O'Neill told us about this a couple of years ago, although back when Paul O'Neill said it, they all said, well, you know, he's sour grapes. You can't believe him. But anyhow, they're saying this is an old story. This is, you know, number one. Or number two, they're saying, you know, so what? It's, you know, this is, we're there. We've got to deal with it. And, I don't recall the same mainstream media saying when it was coming out that Bill Clinton had lied about having sex with Monica Lewinsky, hey, come on, that was 2 years ago that he had sex with her. Why are we talking about it now? Or, hey, we all knew that Bill was a little randy. I mean, it's been in the tabloids ever since he was governor of Arkansas. I don't recall having heard that from the opinionators, with Chris Matthews and whatnot. But now all of a sudden it's like, you know, what's the deal here? Is any of the mainstream media, Michael Giltz, is any of the mainstream media dealing with this and talking about the fact that, hey, if lying to the American people and lying to Congress is an impeachable offense, if it constitutes a high crime and misdemeanor as defined by the Constitution, and certainly this Congress thought it did just 5 years ago, 6, 7 years ago, in the case of Bill Clinton lying about Monica Lewinsky, and if George Bush had actually decided, not only decided, but laid plans to invade Iraq at the time that he said...
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
At the time he said that, and in fact that was a lie, why is that, you know, is that not a high crime or misdemeanor? Why, do you know of any mainstream media that is covering this as a the president lied story?
Not one, not even close. I mean, you look at when the media does stick its neck out, Newsweek reporting on abuse of the Quran, one of their sources backtracked on them. The White House jumped on them as if they were responsible for riots all over the world. And a week later, the Pentagon releases a report saying, yes, of course, they have defaced the Quran and mistreated it mightily. So every time the media starts to get a little gumption, they get slapped back down again. No one's even close to saying that this is an impeachable offense. But they are starting to do a little bit better. We've gotten them to talk about the Downing Street memo. We've got a great link on AmericaBlog.org to ABC's Terry Moran, who is in a press conference with Scott McClellan, and it's just a hilarious back and forth where Moran is talking about the death throes of the insurgency, which Dick Cheney and others have been referring to for the past 2 years. And he keeps asking Scott, well, how long can a death throe last? How long can an insurgency be in its last throes? And McClellan just got more and more angry and upset. And it's good to see them actually pushing them on these. You know, they keep repeating these lies or these little half-truths, and the media is finally starting to call them on it.
Yeah, the thing that really boggles my mind is the question. What boggles my mind is that this question hasn't been asked, the following question. If Mr. McClellan or Mr. Rumsfeld or Mr. Cheney or whomever, you know, if what you say is true, that we know that we're winning in Iraq because the number of attacks is increasing and the number of dead Americans is increasing, and that's a sign of, you know, growing desperation on the part of the other side. If we know by the fact that we're suffering more casualties that we're winning, how would we know if we were losing? I'm serious. How would we know? Would it mean that if they all laid down their weapons and stopped shooting at us, then we'd know that we were losing? I mean, it's why hasn't a single reporter just asked that simple question? So, and Michael, you raised this whole issue of Iraq. You know, what are the other things that are hot in the blogosphere right now?
For AmericaBlog.org, we've been having a great run on the lynching resolution that was put forth in the Senate this week. The Senate put forth one of the resolutions that they do all the time to make a statement about an issue. They're usually banal. You know, it's National Ice Cream Day. It's National Titmouse Day. But some of them are very serious. And this one resolution that was put forward was the Senate apologizing for have dragging its heels for more than a century on anti-lynching laws, making lynching a federal crime and going after the lynchings that were occurring throughout the country, mostly the South, for more than a century. And it seems like a pretty innocuous thing. Who isn't against lynching? But in fact, what happened was, what should have been a positive, something to put to rest an ugly issue from the Senate's past, became a really ugly issue today. Senator First refused to hold the vote during the day. He did it late Monday night so that it would get as little media coverage as possible. He refused an up-and-down vote like the sponsors of the legislation wanted because he knew that one out of four Republicans did not support this. One out of four Republicans in the Senate refused to co-sponsor this resolution, didn't want to go anywhere near it, certainly didn't want to have to vote for it. Why? Because they're from places like Mississippi, Alabama, and Texas. And there are still 14 Republican senators who have refused to co-sponsor this resolution against lynching.
Yeah, both senators from Utah, both senators from Texas, both senators from Mississippi, for example.
Yeah, what a shock that it would be those places. Now the NAACP is starting to pay attention. They are blasting the Texas senators. And the mainstream media, like you say, again, tried to blow this off. They thought, oh, boy, resolutions come up every day. It's just a boring little thing. We know it's not really important. But, in fact, the Republicans have really created a problem for themselves. They've treated something that should have been a positive and made it a negative. They've shown sort of an ugly heart to the Republican Party and to these senators from the South who are afraid to come out against lynching. There's apparently a lynching gap between the Republicans and the Democrats.
Yeah. a lynching constituency is needed by the Republicans in order to win the elections, apparently. David Swanson, what are you seeing beyond just the Downing Street memos that are coming out of these things? And the other question that I have for both of you, by the way, and David, you can take a first shot at it, is if George Bush were impeached and we ended up with Dick Cheney as president and Denny Hastert as vice president, is that really a desirable outcome?
Well, first question first, you know, the Downing Street minutes that came out and then these additional documents keep coming out, many of which were known in England but are new here. And there are going to be more like that, and there are going to be more that are new on both sides. But if this is old news, then that means the president is lying to us now. You know, the president is lying about the facts in the Downing Street minutes now when he's asked about it. So, you know, and Congress is willing to dig up stories like steroids in sports and go back years and look at the facts and figure out what happened and not say that's old, you know. But your other question, we're getting way ahead of ourselves to think about who's next after Bush, but we can't refrain from performing our responsibility to hold the president accountable and Congress performing its responsibility to have some checks and balances in our system because we're worried that the next guy might be worse. I mean, the one thing we know for a fact about the next guy is that he will operate under the threat of impeachment should he commit high crimes. Now, if we want to get into it, it's likely that an investigation of Bush would lead to an investigation of Cheney as well, and we would face President Hastert. But I just think that's getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah. Now, here's taking it to the next step, Michael Giltz. The Constitution specifies three things that are reasons for impeachment. Number one, treason. Number two, high crimes or misdemeanors, which is kind of vague. That's actually number three, but save number two to last. And the other one is bribery. We learned this week that unilaterally, without even the tobacco industry asking, the tobacco industry, which had given about $10 million to the Republicans, just got a $100 billion gift from the Bush Justice Department, and this sure looks like bribery to me. Bribery is one of the two crimes, bribery and treason, that are specified as grounds for impeachment. Anybody talking about that in the blogosphere?
Absolutely. We've been covering that. The lowering of the tobacco settlement is ridiculous. And as we've seen, it came from, the former tobacco attorney Robert McCollum is the one pushing the Justice Department to lower the settlement. And it ties right in with the other Bush administration official who cut down all the scientific warnings on global warming, and a week later went to work for ExxonMobil. You know, former tobacco attorney comes into the government and pushes the Justice Department to lower the settlement. Another Bush official leaves the government to go work for ExxonMobil right after undercutting the scientific facts on global warming. It's an ugly pattern. It certainly looks like bribery to us.
Why are these not then being, David Swanson, why are these then not being covered by the mainstream media as scandals?
Well, the mainstream media has to be dragged, pushing, and pulling into making a scandal of something that figures of power in politics are not promoting. If the Bush administration and the Republican leadership are not promoting something, and if the Democratic leadership is not united and full throttle on it, then the media is not going to go out of its way, no matter how good a story it looks like. And, you know, in terms of impeachment, we have the 1996 War Crimes Act that says that violating the Geneva Convention is violating U.S. law. This is potentially a problem for, you know, we saw a story today in the Independent in the U.K. About the Bush administration lying to the Blair administration about using napalm-like weapons in Iraq. We have depleted uranium. We have targeting of civilians. So
cluster bombs.
Cluster bombs, yeah. If you want to start talking about additional possible reasons for impeachment, it can get a little out of control very quickly. And so we're focused heavily on what we think is one of the most damning pieces of evidence about the most serious high crime.
Yeah, and that's I guess the way it should be done. AfterDowningStreet.org, David Swanson's website, Michael Giltz at AmericaBlog.com or AmericaBlog.org. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And keep up the great work, both of you. We still have a long way to go before we sleep, as they say. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. It's never too late to start
all over again. And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, Live365's American FM, WhiteRoseSociety.org, where you can also find archives of the program, and on cable systems in 29 states on CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. It's Friday afternoon. We normally do our best of the rest of the news about this time. Get on a couple of folks who are right in the middle of it, right in the thick of it, in the news out there, in the blogosphere, in the newsosphere, as it were. And today we have with us Michael Giltz. Michael Giltz is the writer on AmericaBlog.com or AmericaBlog.org, either one will get you there, who broke the Jeff Gannon story. Hey, Michael, welcome.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here. It was our website's founder, John Aravosis, who helped break the Jeff Gannon story.
Okay, great. I stand corrected.
Along with other blogs. We want to give credit wherever it's due, of course.
There you go. And also with us, David Swanson of AfterDowningStreet.org. David Swanson, I would say instrumental in helping bring about the hearings that happened yesterday. I'm sure that John Conyers, you would say, gets more credit than you, but you certainly brought a lot of attention to this, David.
Well, John Conyers did host the hearings, and he deserves no limit of credit for what he's doing.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. So let me start with you, David, if I may. Tell us what happened yesterday at the hearing. I know that you were there. In fact, your partner in the AfterDowningStreet.org, John Boniface, who was on this program earlier in the week, testified there yesterday. In fact, I've got a little clip of his testimony that we can get to if you'd like. Tell us what happened.
Oh, well, John was brilliant, as was Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst for 27 years, as was Cindy Sheehan, whose son died in Iraq and who founded Gold Star Families for Peace, as was former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who discredited the information about Iraq building nuclear weapons, and whose wife, as a consequence, was outed as a CIA analyst by the Bush administration. That was the panel, those four, and then there were about 35 Congress members who came in and out. The Republicans had scheduled an unprecedented number of votes and other important meetings during the time, not to mention relegating this to a tiny room in the basement. But it was quite impressive, and every media outlet in the country fit in there regardless. And it was 2.5 hours, and it moved steadily from we're interested in these questions to this sounds like impeachment.
Interesting. Very interesting. It's and Michael Giltz, are you, you know, out on America Blog? What's the response that folks are, that you're getting to this event?
Well, we've got a link to crooksandliars.com. They have a great half-hour condensation of the hearings. I believe the hearings are also being rebroadcast on C-SPAN 3 for those of those with digital cable tonight at 8 p.m., but you'd have to check your listings to make sure about that. But I got to admit, it gave us a sort of a visceral thrill to hear John talking about impeachment proceedings. That's certainly the conversation we like to have people be discussing rather than something else. It was, you know, a lot of people have been following the Downing Street memos. We've got a link today to the BBC, which is crediting the bloggers in America for putting this issue into the mainstream media. And that's really, you know, what we were focused on and trying to do for the past month. We thought it was important. We thought it was something the American people needed to hear about. We couldn't believe the mainstream media wasn't covering it. And after a month of keeping this issue alive on the blog, the Washington Post and other media outlets finally picked up on it. Congressman Conyers having the hearings. It's made a big difference. It's a news story now.
Yeah, there you go. And in fact, here's John Boniface speaking yesterday before the Conyers Commission.
The recent release of the Downing Street minutes provides new and compelling evidence that the President of the United States has been actively engaged in a conspiracy to deceive and mislead the United States Congress and the American people about the basis for going to war against Iraq. If true, such conduct constitutes a high crime under Article 2, Section 4 of the United States Constitution, which states, "The President, Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors."
And David Swanson, John is not just some guy with a website. He's a constitutional lawyer, is he not?
John is a certified genius. You know, he got one of those genius grants. He is a brilliant guy. He is he's a well-known and experienced constitutional attorney and an expert on these issues. And he's one of the co-founders of AfterDowningStreet.org. And he's the movement behind this campaign. But I want to give some credit to the bloggers too. And second, what was said a moment ago. You know, it was this alliance of hundreds of bloggers that formed on its own, joined with our coalition, pushed this issue and drove it into the mainstream media, and I don't think we're beyond the point now where it's going to go on its own without that. I think we're going to have to continue with the blogs and the websites and the progressive media outlets to keep pushing this into the mainstream media and into it in the right way.
Well, in fact, all the media I'm hearing, David, and you as well, Michael, all the mainstream media that I'm hearing is saying basically one of two things. Either A, hey, this is an old story. We already knew that George Bush wanted to go to war. Paul O'Neill told us about this a couple of years ago. Although back when Paul O'Neill said it, they all said, well, you know, he's sour grapes. You can't believe him. But anyhow, they're saying this is an old story. This is, you know, number one. Or number two, they're saying, you know, so what? It's, you know, this is, we're there. We've got to deal with it. And, I don't recall the same mainstream media saying when it was coming out that Bill Clinton had lied about having sex with Monica Lewinsky, hey, come on, that was 2 years ago that he had sex with her. Why are we talking about it now? Or, hey, we all knew that Bill was a little randy. I mean, it's been in the tabloids ever since he was governor of Arkansas. I don't recall having heard that from the opinionators, with Chris Matthews and whatnot. But now all of a sudden it's like, you know, what's the deal here? Is any of the mainstream media, Michael Giltz, is any of the mainstream media dealing with this and talking about the fact that, hey, if lying to the American people and lying to Congress is an impeachable offense, if it constitutes a high crime and misdemeanor as defined by the Constitution, and certainly this Congress thought it did just 5 years ago, 6, 7 years ago, in the case of Bill Clinton lying about Monica Lewinsky, and if George Bush had actually decided, not only decided, but laid plans to invade Iraq at the time that he said...
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
At the time he said that, and in fact that was a lie, why is that, you know, is that not a high crime or misdemeanor? Why, do you know of any mainstream media that is covering this as the president lied story?
Not one, not even close. I mean, you look at when the media does stick its neck out, Newsweek reporting on abuse of the Quran, one of their sources backtracked on them. The White House jumped on them as if they were responsible for riots all over the world. And a week later, the Pentagon releases a report saying, yes, of course, they have defaced the Quran and mistreated it mightily. So every time the media starts to get a little gumption, they get slapped back down again. No one's even close to saying that this is an impeachable offense. But they are starting to do a little bit better. We've gotten them to talk about the Downing Street memo. We've got a great link on AmericaBlog.org to ABC's Terry Moran, who is in a press conference with Scott McClellan, and it's just a hilarious back and forth where Moran is talking about the death throes of the insurgency, which Dick Cheney and others have been referring to for the past 2 years. And he keeps asking Scott, well, how long can a death throw last? How long can an insurgency be in its last throes? And McClellan just got more and more angry and upset. And it's good to see them actually pushing them on these. You know, they keep repeating these lies or these little half-truths, and the media is finally starting to call them on it.
Yeah, the thing that really boggles my mind is the question. What boggles my mind is that this question hasn't been asked, the following question. If Mr. McClellan or Mr. Rumsfeld or Mr. Cheney or whomever, you know, if what you say is true, that we know that we're winning in Iraq because the number of attacks is increasing and the number of dead Americans is increasing, and that's a sign of, you know, growing desperation on the part of the other side. If we know by the fact that we're suffering more casualties that we're winning, how would we know if we were losing? I'm serious. How would we know? Would it mean that if they all laid down their weapons and stopped shooting at us, then we'd know that we were losing? I mean, it's like you know, why hasn't a single reporter just asked that simple question? So and Michael, you raised this whole issue of Iraq. You know, what are the other things that are hot in the blogosphere right now?
For AmericaBlog.org, we've been having a great run on the lynching resolution that was put forth in the Senate this week. The Senate put forth one of the resolutions that they do all the time to make a statement about an issue. They're usually banal. You know, it's National Ice Cream Day. It's National Titmouse Day. But some of them are very serious. And this one resolution that was put forward was the Senate apologizing for have dragging its heels for more than a century on anti-lynching laws, making lynching a federal crime and going after the lynchings that were occurring throughout the country, mostly the South. For more than a century. And it seems like a pretty innocuous thing. Who isn't against lynching? But in fact, what happened was, what should have been a positive, something to put to rest an ugly issue from the Senate's past, became a really ugly issue today. Senator Frist refused to hold the vote during the day. He did it late Monday night so that it would get as little media coverage as possible. He refused an up and down vote, like the sponsors of the legislation wanted, because he knew that one out of four Republicans did not support this. One out of four Republicans in the Senate refused to co-sponsor this resolution, didn't want to go anywhere near it, certainly didn't want to have to vote for it. Why? Because they're from places like Mississippi, Alabama, and Texas. And there are still 14 Republican senators who have refused to co-sponsor this resolution against lynching.
Yeah, both senators from Utah, both senators from Texas, both senators from Mississippi, for example.
Yeah, what a shock that it would be those places. Now the NAACP is starting to pay attention. They are blasting the Texas senators. And the mainstream media, like you say, again, tried to blow this off. They thought, oh, boy, resolutions come up every day. It's just a boring little thing. We know it's not really important. But, in fact, the Republicans have really created a problem for themselves. They've treated something that should have been a positive and made it a negative. They've shown sort of an ugly heart to the Republican Party and to these senators from the South who are afraid to come out against lynching. There's apparently a lynching gap between the Republicans and the Democrats.
Yeah. a lynching constituency is needed by the Republicans in order to win the elections, apparently. David Swanson, what are you seeing beyond just the Downing Street memos that are coming out of these things? And the other question that I have for both of you, by the way, and David, you can take a first shot at it, is if George Bush were impeached and we ended up with Dick Cheney as president and Denny Hastert as vice president, is that really a desirable outcome?
Well, first question first, you know, the Downing Street minutes that came out and then these additional documents keep coming out, many of which were known in England but are new here. And there are going to be more like that, and there are going to be more that are new on both sides. But if this is old news, then that means the president is lying to us now. You know, the president is lying about the facts in the Downing Street minutes now when he's asked about it. So, you know, and Congress is willing to dig up stories like steroids in sports and go back years and look at the facts and figure out what happened and not say that's old, you know. But your other question, we're getting way ahead of ourselves to think about who's next after Bush, but we can't refrain from performing our responsibility to hold the president accountable and Congress performing its responsibility to have some checks and balances in our system because we're worried that the next guy might be worse. I mean, the one thing we know for a fact about the next guy is that he will operate under the threat of impeachment should he commit high crimes. Now, if we want to get into it, it's likely that an investigation of Bush would lead to an investigation of Cheney as well, and we would face President Hastert. But I just think that's getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah. Now, here's taking it to the next step, Michael Giltz. The Constitution specifies three things that are reasons for impeachment. Number one, treason. Number two, high crimes or misdemeanors, which is kind of vague. That's actually number three, but save number two to last. And the other one is bribery. We learned this week that unilaterally, without even the tobacco industry asking, the tobacco industry, which had given about $10 million to the Republicans, just got a $100 billion gift from the Bush Justice Department, and this sure looks like bribery to me. Bribery is one of the two crimes, bribery and treason, that are specified as grounds for impeachment. Anybody talking about that in the blogosphere?
Absolutely. We've been covering that. The lowering of the tobacco settlement is ridiculous. And as we've seen, it came from, the former tobacco attorney, Robert McCollum, is the one pushing the Justice Department to lower the settlement. And it ties right in with the other Bush administration official who cut down all the scientific warnings on global warming, and a week later went to work for ExxonMobil. You know, former tobacco attorney comes into the government and pushes the Justice Department to lower the settlement. Another Bush official leaves the government to go work for ExxonMobil right after undercutting the scientific facts on global warming. It's an ugly pattern. It certainly looks like bribery to us.
Why are these not then being, David Swanson, why are these then not being covered by the mainstream media as scandals?
Well, the mainstream media has to be dragged, pushing, and pulling into making a scandal of something that figures of power in politics are not promoting. If the Bush administration and the Republican leadership are not promoting something, and if the Democratic leadership is not united and full throttle on it, then the media is not going to go out of its way, no matter how good a story it looks like. And, you know, in terms of impeachment, we have the 1996 War Crimes Act that says that violating the Geneva Convention is violating U.S. law. This is potentially a problem for, you know, we saw a story today in the Independent in the U.K. About the Bush administration lying to the Blair administration about using napalm-like weapons in Iraq. We have depleted uranium. We have targeting of civilians. So
cluster bombs.
Cluster bombs, yeah. If you want to start talking about additional possible reasons for impeachment, it can get a little out of control very quickly. And so we're focused heavily on what we think is one of the most damning pieces of evidence about the most serious high crime.
Yeah, and that's I guess the way it should be done. AfterDowningStreet.org, David Swanson's website, Michael Giltz at AmericaBlog.com or AmericaBlog.org. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us today.
Thank you,
Tom.
And keep up the great work, both of you. We still have a long way to go before we sleep, as they say. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 10 minutes before the hour.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lindball.
This is the old Brush Show.
The man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on stations from California to Pennsylvania, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, Live365's American FM, and in 29 states, cable systems on CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. It's the No Boring Zone. Lori Wallach is a trade attorney and the director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. This was founded by Ralph Nader originally. Hey, Lori.
How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. Glad to have you with us on the program today. Citizen.org is the website for Public Citizen, by the way, for our listeners. We have now CAFTA before us. 44 million people in Central America who more than half of them right at this moment living on less than $2 a day, who are soon, if CAFTA is passed, going to be competing with American workers for their jobs. And I'm assuming that they'll be willing to work for less than American minimum wage, so we've got a lot of multinational corporations salivating at this. Their combined purchasing power of these 44 million people, is equal to that of the city of New Haven, Connecticut. It doesn't look like it's a good deal for the United States, particularly if NAFTA and the WTO are any indicator, you know, if the past predicts the future. And yet your new report indicates that there are a lot of members of Congress who may vote for this thing because promises are being made, and actually your report is more retrospective than prospective. Promises are being made certainly around CAFTA right now. For example, don't worry, we'll negotiate future fixes for environment and labor deals and things like that. But in the past, promises were made around NAFTA, and what happened?
Well, systematically, the promises were broken, and it's not just around NAFTA, actually. We looked at what this George W. Bush administration has been up to as far as the promises it made to try and pass bad trade policies, like for instance, they're getting fast-track trade authority and some past other bilateral free trade agreements. And it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican, you're Clinton, Daddy Bush, or Baby Bush. The statistic is, basically, of the 93 different promises of three administrations over 12 years, over 90% of them are broken.
Promises like?
Well, there were two categories that we researched. One was a set of promises that we called policy fixes. That's sort of what you just described, which is the member of Congress more or less knows from their constituents that a trade agreement's a bad idea for that district. And so they say, well, if you can help me deal with this particular commodity, protect asparagus, folks up in the upper part of Michigan who listened to you, remember that whole deal, or alternatively, I promise you afterwards I'll renegotiate this provision and create strong labor protections or make sure that below-cost products aren't dumped on your state that you guys make.
Right.
Of those promises, 95% were broken.
Hmm.
Then there was the second category, which we call the pork barrel deals, and those promises were things unrelated to the trade agreement. So it was just pure gluttony. It wasn't, we'll fix the problem you're worried about, but rather, go ahead, vote in a way that screws your constituents, but we'll give you a bridge.
What in the old days used to be called bribery?
That would still be a clear definition.
Yeah.
And of those, two-thirds of those were broken.
Did these members of Congress, members of Congress and the Senate who had accepted these bribes and then didn't get paid off, were they a little upset? Was there any retribution? Anybody screaming?
Well, in several cases, actually, members of Congress who were repeated offenders, who kept, in one case, taking the same promise and getting hosed each time and voting for bad trade agreements, got run out of office. That would be Congressman Tom Sawyer in Akron, Ohio. Another congressman, Congressman Martinez in Southern California, lost his seat after repeatedly doing the same shenanigans. But to some degree, I guess there are two take-home lessons from this report. One is, folks, now is the time to make sure your member of Congress doesn't vote for NAFTA expansion. CAFTA and NAFTA's rhyming is not a coincidence. CAFTA is 90% identical to NAFTA, and the other 10% suck worse than NAFTA.
Right.
So in this instance, on the merits, the good news is there's a majority right now in Congress who's against this. There are almost every single Democrat, handful of them aren't. You can look at our website, tradewatch.org, gets you right to the list to figure out who's out there and needs some work. And 40 Republicans are against CAFTA. So now the Bush administration is really up a crick. So they're now starting to say, well, we've lost on the merits. Of course, they don't quite fess up to that. And we're now going to have to try and figure out some way to buy it. Our report, point two, I think, probably helps members of Congress understand how systematic will be their political liability
mm-hmm.
if they do this.
Do you think that, and the report is at citizen.org/trade, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Get it there, too.
Do you really think that members of Congress are going to be reading this?
Well, we put it into everyone's hands yesterday. We did a hand delivery door-to-door. And, you know, it's interesting. There are lots of really excellent reports showing how NAFTA's failed. It's undermined our standard of living, undermined the standard of living people in Mexico, trashed the environment. All those studies are out there. But if you find a member of Congress who's read it, it's unusual. In this instance, because it has to do about them and their friends, in fact, it's selling like a hot potato.
Hmm.
So even after we dropped it, we've been getting calls saying, oh, we hear there's this report that we're perhaps listed in.
Yes.
So, and in fact, you know, no one is spared. It's a bipartisan list of shame.
Yeah.
But here's the thing about this, which is there's still work to be done from folks at home to call the member of Congress, because basically this report shows if you take a trade deal, you got a 95% chance you're going to have such a transparent fig leaf that you could be arrested for indecent exposure.
Okay.
However, it's only if we all, as voters,
right,
move on that and threaten a member that we're going to get rid of them if they keep repeatedly supporting these bad trade agreements, that anything's going to happen. And
yeah,
so now's the time to do it.
Lori Wallach, you're an attorney who's familiar with these topics of trade. You've been around, you know, this block for a while. Also the director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. It's something that has baffled me, and I still actually have the front page of the Wall Street Journal from the day that it happened. There was an article in the front page of the Wall Street Journal about how Bill Clinton was, the reason I clipped it actually was because it seemed to describe attention deficit disorder behavior, and I'd written a book about that, and I was looking for examples. It was talking about how he was working so hard to make NAFTA work, and it was describing him in the White House doing call after call to members of Congress and you know, bending arms and making deals and horse trading, and he'd hang up the phone, he'd turn to the reporter and go, God, I love this, and you know, just in the heat of it, and the question that was asked by the Wall Street Journal reporter was, you know, why is this guy staking his presidency on this high wire act, on something that may fall apart or something that may not even work out? And of course, the conclusion that they came to in the Wall Street Journal was that it had something to do with his biology. It had to do with the you know, that he was a risk taker. And they talked about him jumping off the main mast of the Kennedy yacht and all these other risks. This was all before Monica had come out. And I'm wondering why, you know, and I couldn't figure out, I mean, here's the Wall Street Journal saying that they can't figure out why Bill Clinton was pushing NAFTA and WTO. I can't figure it out either. Why? What? Who got to him? Or did he really believe this ideology? Or was this part of this new Democrat thing about reinventing the Democratic Party as Republican light? Or, you know, what happened?
Well, speculation, because I'm certainly not inside his head, but I think that there were two things going on simultaneously. One, Bill Clinton believed in all of these theories, and he was very much in a circle of elite thinkers who believed in NAFTA and WTO delivering on making the world more prosperous, people in the U.S. more prosperous, etc. But at the same time, I think that there was also a big political and money factor, which certainly is also true with President Bush, and then times 10, which is a lot of very powerful, very large commercial interests in the U.S. are winning under these deals. I mean, we need trade rules, but the question is what rules? And so with NAFTA, the set of rules are those which perhaps a corporate CEO would have a lovely dream about, but couldn't imagine ever getting away with putting in policies into effect.
The corporate CEOs wrote these trade deals, did they not?
But in this instance, they basically got to write the rules. And we all know he or she who writes the rules rules. And these are a lot of the same folks who are funding the Clinton administration's election efforts, and certainly who are all of Bush's big buddies and contributors. And so all of us out there who are a majority with our votes, with our feet, with our voices, basically get steamrolled in these deals because we're not making the big fat checks.
Yeah.
But now is the time we can make a difference, because CAFTA is the turning point. We've had 11 years of seeing what NAFTA actually did. And interestingly, a lot of those Clinton folks who were big NAFTA supporters have now said, no, we shouldn't do CAFTA. NAFTA didn't work out along the way we planned. There's things in there we do not want to expand. Those things are in CAFTA. So, for instance, the former United States Trade Representative, Mickey Cantor, who was the guy who pushed NAFTA through,
right,
has said, no, we shouldn't do CAFTA. This is not the model. It's going to work. Some things need to be changed.
Yeah, just a few, huh?
But we all really, really, really need to make clear our members of Congress hear that from us, because on the other side, basically, you can't roll a dime down the hall of lobbies of Congress right now without running into a Gucci loafer, because every big corporate lobbyist is out there pushing CAFTA as we speak. They want to have a vote on this in the next couple of weeks. So there's a number of the Capitol switchboard, which I'm going to say a couple times. It's 202-225-3121. 3121.
Actually, let me give you an easier one, Lori. That's the toll number, toll-free number for Congress. And this gets you to the exact same switchboard, the exact same operators, but it's toll-free all across the United States, and it's real easy to remember. It's 1-877-SOB, the letter U, S-O-B. 1-877-SOB-USOB gets you the Capitol switchboard. Honest to God, I am not kidding. It's the old Senate office building number.
When you're there, it's very easy, folks. Even if you're not sure who your member of the House of Representatives is, all you have to do is just give the zip code of where you live. And then they'll tell you that the Capitol switchboard operators are very nice. They'll tell you who it is, and they'll connect you right there. And when you get there, you just say, I want to register my opinion on CAFTA. Where is my member? I'm from your district. Where is my member of Congress going to vote? If they tell you that they're voting against it, voting no, you say, thank you very much. Take my name and my address. I'd like a letter reaffirming that. If they say they don't know, then tell them, you better vote no. Otherwise, all folks back home who are hurt are going to make sure you know next election time and ask for a letter. And if they say they're for it, tell them, basically, that you will not be supporting them and you're going to find all your friends to do the like. And why would they possibly do this? Just to keep the heat on. We need to keep doing this basically on a daily basis. Put that number on your refrigerator and keep calling and bugging them until you get them to do the right thing, because this is actually a trade agreement we can stop. And if we do, the political signal we send basically is that business as usual with these trade agreements is over. You're going to have to do it different or no more trade agreements.
Right. If you want to pay for the call, it's 202-225-3121. But if you want to dial free on your own tax nickel, I guess it's not free ultimately. It's 877, toll-free, 877-SOB-U, the letter U, S-O-B, as in Senate Office Building, United States Senate Office Building, S-O-B-U-S-O-B, 1-877-SOB-U-S-O-B. Let them know what you think. And if you want more information, you can go to citizen.org/trade for more information on this. Lori Wallach, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I do appreciate it. Great work you're doing. Please keep it up. It's absolutely marvelous organization. Public Citizen, citizen.org/trade on this topic. Lori Wallach with us today. I'm Tom Harbin. We'll be back 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the radio home of democracy, the Tom Hartman radio program, the No Boring Zone. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has churned out 36 radio and TV news segments since the first of the year that promote CAFTA, we were just speaking about. Your tax dollars being used to generate propaganda. Yeah, seriously. Yeah, it is, this stuff is being cranked out. 36 of them, since the first of the year, that are being used on radio and TV. The prepackaged reports have been widely distributed to broadcast outlets across the country for easy insertion into newscasts. In one radio segment, Agriculture Secretary Mike Johann says that passing CAFTA should be an easy decision for members of Congress. And on camera, he says, quote, I can't imagine how any senator or House member from ag county country could stand up and vote against CAFTA. It makes no sense to me. It's voting against our producers. End quote. In another radio segment promoting CAFTA, Alan Johnson, a top U.S. trade official, dismissed the sugar industry's dire forecasts about CAFTA's impact as a chicken little sort of thing that isn't real, he says. Yeah. The folks in our chat room asking for a Guccellini update. Guccellini, the goose that was living on the back of our house, on the deck in the back of our house. We live in a sort of a houseboat, I guess you'd call it, floating house. And this goose, we thought he was just an absolute maniac. He was out there and he wouldn't let anybody near. Any goose that got within 150 feet or so of the place, he would just go shooting after them. Quack, 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 or honk, honk, I guess. I can't quite make a goose noise, but it's not like, you know, ducks go wah, 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 and geese do something different. Anyway, and so we named him Guccellini, but it turns out that there was a female goose on the next house over's deck that was sitting on an egg, and it was Guccellini's egg. And that egg has hatched, and we now have a gosling. He's acquired another one from somebody else as well. We're not sure how that came about, but he has two now. They're clearly slightly different ages, and they're happily paddling around in the water. And now there's like 15 or 20 geese hanging around, and Louise goes out and feeds them, and that can you spell goose poop? So that's that. There's the Goosellini update. The front page of the Wall Street Journal today. The cuckoos wonder why a sacred glacier melts in Peru's Andes. This on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. The subhead of this story by Antonio Rigaldo. It could portend world's end. So mountain worshippers are stewarding the ice. The story opens in Dateline Peru on the Kelkemku Glacier. One recent moonlit night high in the Peruvian Andes, about 200 men dressed in furry cloaks and woolen masks trekked up a glacier whose ice is said to have healing, magical healing qualities. They call them the Bear Men because of the outfits that they wear. They say their sacred glacier is disappearing. Over a period of two decades, its edge has drawn back 600 feet along the boulder-strewn slope leading to the church in the valley below, according to the people there. Even compared with last year, the glacier is noticeably smaller. And then the Wall Street Journal notes in its front page story, although few in this remote mountaintop are aware of it, the demise of this Andean ice-cutting ritual, this is these guys going up and cutting ice to bring down as holy water, is likely the result of global warming. The end of the ice-cutting ritual is, of course, associated with the end of the glacier. This global warming, according to local myth, they add, when the snow disappears from the tops of the mountains, it will herald the end of the world. In 1780, in this place, as tradition has it, Jesus appeared on the mountain in the guise of a little blonde boy. And thus, the glacial ice is considered to be holy water. The cuckoos first started getting worried about the ice in 1993, notes the Wall Street Journal. The mystical bear men, who consider themselves guardians of the snow, worried that taking the ice might be causing it to shrink. They can't figure out what's going on. They don't know about global warming. And despite the ban on cutting big blocks, many cuckoos still stuff snow into soda bottles to take home. They say, we don't take ice anymore because it's diminishing. We just take a little. The bear men of Curitiba always speak in high falsetto while in costume, asked what the cause of the melting could be. One of them said, it is the will of El Señor. They don't realize El Señor is named George Bush. 29 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Now I can understand why you were hot, 'cause Bin Laden never did get caught. So you said we had Saddam to blame, tried to tell us it was all the same.
Yes,
now the years roll by and our kids keep dying. You don't even have a plan to bring them home. And those WMD you promised on TV, hey, you figured it wrong, so I'm taking my country back.
Yes, indeed, time to take back the stars and stripes, my friends. Time to take back our country. Where do you do it? You do it in the polling place. You do it in the ballot box. You do it by getting politically active. You do it by waking people up, by getting involved. Getting involved. Absolutely, positively, all the time, full-blown necessary.
Now, the DeLay Political Death Watch.
Yes, records show legal debts for Tom DeLay. His 2004 bills of $125,000 to $315,000 stem from ethics probes. House Majority Leader Tom DeLay racked up large legal debts last year as he faced a series of ethics probes. We might add, while several of his friends were convicted of crimes or doing things associated with him, DeLay owed three law firms between $125,000 and $315,000, the records indicate, even though a defense fund to defray the congressman's legal costs had raised $439,300. So let's see, $439,000 plus $315,000, that's like $750,000, more or less, that Tom DeLay so far has had to pay defending himself, a poor guy. And now, on top of that, we discover that, you know, he owns a whole bunch of ExxonMobil stock at the same time that he's out there, you know, lobbying, essentially, doing their bidding. So lots of raised eyebrows in the Tom DeLay department. It's getting rather strange in Congress, getting rather strange. This is another one. This story, this is an eyeball popper. ABC's bosses tell, as in eyes popping out, ABC's bosses tell ABC News to kill interviews with Robert Kennedy Jr. This in Arianna Huffington's blog. ABC corporate executives at the network's highest levels ordered three interviews with Robert Kennedy Jr. pulled from ABC News programming. The interviews all centered around Mr. Kennedy's investigation of Timerosal, a mercury-based preservative used in vaccines given to children and believed to be responsible for increasing cases of neurological diseases, including autism. And who's behind covering this up? Well, it turns out it's Senator Majority Leader Bill Frist, who received $873,000 from pharmaceutical companies, tacked on the Eli Lilly Protection Act as a rider to the 2002 Homeland Security bill. Yeah, Senator Frist is making another attempt to harbor big pharmaceuticals from families with infected children. He's appropriating the war on terror again by attaching a provision to the Protecting America on the War on Terror bill introduced into Congress this past January. Robert Kennedy Jr. laying this stuff out. The article, it's also on Salon.com today. It was embargoed at Salon.com, and I believe that it's running in Rolling Stone. Since 1991, he notes, the article's titled Deadly Immunity. Since 1991, he notes, when the CDC and the FDA had recommended that three additional vaccines laced with this mercury-based preservative be given to extremely young infants, in one case within hours of birth, the estimated numbers of cases of autism has increased 15-fold, from one in every 2,500 children to one in every 166 children. A consultant for the American Academy of Pediatrics, Dr. Bill Weil, said, "You can play with this all you want, but these statistics are statistically significant. These numbers are statistically significant. You just can't get away from it." But, notes Kennedy, instead of taking immediate steps to alert the public and rid the vaccine supply of Timerosal, the officials and executives at Simpsonwood, the company that makes it, spent much of the next 2 days discussing how to cover up the damaging data. According to transcripts obtained under the Freedom of Information Act, many at the meeting were concerned about how the damaging revelations about Timerosal would affect the vaccine industry's bottom line. Even many conservatives were shocked by the government's effort, writes Robert Kennedy, to cover up the dangers of Timerosal. Representative Dan Burton, a Republican from Indiana, oversaw a three-year investigation of Timerosal after his grandson was diagnosed with autism. Timerosal was used as a preservative in vaccines and is directly related to the autism epidemic, his House Government Reform Committee concluded in its final report. This epidemic, in all probability, this is from a final report from the House Government Reform Committee, this epidemic, in all probability, may have been prevented or curtailed had the FDA not been asleep at the switch regarding the lack of safety data regarding injected Timerosal, a known neurotoxin. He says the FDA and other public health agencies failed to act, the committee added, out of institutional malfeasance or self-protection and misplaced protectionism of the pharmaceutical industry. It's the old pay-to-play thing. And here we have now Bill Frist once again trying to attach legislation to protect the pharmaceutical industry from being sued. You know those pesky lawsuits that George Bush talks about? We can't have these frivolous lawsuits. They cause all kinds of problems. Well, they're actually putting legislation. Bill Frist introduced this the first place, along with Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania, introduced legislation. They attached it to the 2002, the big spending bill, you know, for Iraq. Who's going to be against that, right? Nobody was, very few anyway. And, you know, it just steamrolled right through. So Bill Frist attached that thing. And, in fact, they didn't know for a while who did it. There was a period of time there where we weren't sure, you know, who put this thing in here. You know, families can't sue if their kids get autism because the vaccine was dangerous. And now he's going to try and do it again. He's got another rider that he's attaching to the Protecting America and the War on Terror bill. More kids with autism and more profits for the Frist family business. Bill Frist's father is one of the richest men in America because they've made all their money taking public hospitals and turning them private, squeezing the blood out of the people therein and the doctors and nurses. particularly the nurses and the staffs. And, of course, the pharmaceutical industry that so aggressively and enthusiastically supports them. Pretty grim. Pretty grim. And this is just, you know, another dimension of the breathtaking corruption of the Republican Party, and to some extent of the Democratic Party as well, today. And, of course, you know, yes, it's nothing new. The Republican Party was bought out in the 1870s by the railroads. Yeah, I know all that. And the Democratic Party and they've been corrupted in their past, certainly. And this is not, ultimately, it's, you know, corruption is not partisan. But the reality is, at this particular moment in time, that the senior leadership of the Republican Party, Tom DeLay with his stock in ExxonMobil, Bill Frist, his family fortune in the hospital industry, and these just whole, and of course Cheney and Rumsfeld and Condi Rice, an oil tanker named after her, Dick Cheney, Halliburton still owns millions, perhaps tens of millions of dollars worth of stock in Halliburton. He made as much money from Halliburton last year as he did as Vice President of the United States. Can you imagine how the press would deal with it if Al Gore got a paycheck every year from, say, one of the tobacco companies? Can you imagine? I mean, they were all upset because his family, you know, owns farms in Kentucky, and they had historically grown tobacco. And there was this big stink about, hey, Al Gore's family is making some money on tobacco back, you know, when he and Clinton were first running together. And he had nothing to do with it. It wasn't coming to him. It was his family, you know, it was distantly related. Dick Cheney's actually getting a check every year from Halliburton for a couple hundred thousand dollars. Oh, but it's got nothing to do with what's going on in Iraq. It's got nothing to do with the fact that KBR, Kellogg Brown and Root, was just given a contract to build a fifth concentration camp at Guantanamo Bay. And KBR, the Halliburton subsidiary, had reincorporated offshore so that any profit that they make on these government deals that are given to them with your and my tax dollars, that they don't have to pay any income tax on it. I mean, it's over the top. It's out of control. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, if you'd like to call in. Helen in West Virginia, listening on WRVC. Hey, Helen, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to ask if you'd seen the Downing Street memo hearing.
Oh, boy, have I ever. And I've got audio clips. In fact, the first couple hours of the program, we've been talking about it and playing clips of them. Just in acknowledgement of that, there's one in particular, one clip from that in particular that I'm sure that you would appreciate, and I want to play for you. This is Cindy Sheehan. Cindy Sheehan's son, I'm forgetting his name right at the moment. It starts with a C. Anyhow, her son died in Iraq after a few weeks being there. And she was on our program yesterday earlier part of the program. I'm not sure your station carries it.
I saw this last night.
Yeah. Okay. This is absolutely incredible.
I hope everyone listens to it or watches it tonight because they're going to play it at 8 o'clock on.
Yeah.
On
C-SPAN. Yeah, I believe so. So.
And I'm telling you, it brought me to tears.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a very sad situation. All these congressmen from the House were coming in there and running back to vote, and they just put so many votes on them yesterday to attend to. And just like I think it was Marcy Kaptur said, perfect timing, you know?
Yeah, well, the Republicans were just loading up the House. We had Bernie Sanders on the first hour of the program for his traditional hour every Friday, and he said that the Republicans were just loading up the House so that nobody could go do anything. I mean, it was hard to even go to the bathroom because the Republicans were constantly calling for votes and doing and moving all the really important business of the House to that particular time on that particular day so that Conyers' hearing would be under-attended. They still had 35 members of the House of Representatives who showed up for the thing.
Oh, they had quite a few, and it was very immensely disturbing to know so many things. But I just say, Mr. Conyers, bless his heart.
Yeah, John Conyers. He's been a guest on this program many times. He's a good man.
He is a good person.
Helen,
and, Thank you very much. I just wanted to check because I hadn't heard you say anything pertaining to it while I'm listening, you know.
I'm sorry. I'll get to it right now. Helen, thank
right
you
there.
Very much for the call. Great
thank
to hear
you.
From you. I do appreciate it. In fact, here is Cindy Sheehan, and I'll give you a little commentary on this as it goes along. First of all, she talks about here we are in Iraq. How did we get into here? How did this thing start out? How did
I am
happen?
Even more convinced now that this aggression on Iraq was based on a lie of historic proportions and was blatantly unnecessary. The so-called Downing Street memo dated 23 July 2002 only confirms what I already suspected. The leadership of this country rushed us into an illegal invasion of another sovereign country on prefabricated and cherry-picked intelligence. Iraq was no threat to the United States of America, and the devastating sanctions and bombing raids against Iraq were working.
Now she goes into, this is what I've been saying on this program for a year and a half at least, that George Bush, that the real reason why George Bush went into Iraq was not oil. Oil was the secondary reason. The real reason was political power. Because if you've got political power, then you can get oil. It wasn't money. It was political power. Because if you've got political power, you can get money. And they wanted to get the Republicans reelected in 2002. And they wanted to get George reelected, or elected for the first time, technically, in 2004. And he knew that as a war president, he could make that happen. Here's Cindy Sheehan again talking about this.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote. It looks like George Bush was ready to lead this country into an avoidable war even before he became president.
There you go. In his own words, in 1999, as governor of Texas, George Bush saying that, you know, if he has a chance to invade, he's going to use that political capital. And he did. He used it to take back the Senate in 2002, and he used it to get himself elected in 2004. And just that simple. Bush lied, and Americans died. Not to mention Iraqis. Bush lied, and human beings died. I mean, here we have, you know, Bill Clinton lied, and nobody died, as far as I can tell. 1-866-889-8894. Dale in Nebraska. Hey, Dale, what's up?
Hi, Tom. A couple of issues. I can answer the NAFTA question with regards to our Secretary of Agriculture, Mr. Johans.
Yeah?
He's a lap poodle.
To whom?
Well, to the special interests, of course. I mean, we lived with that man as governor here for some years.
You're talking about the multinational corporations who are
yes,
the main beneficiaries of these
trade deals.
The Cargills. Yeah.
Yes, more of the Cargill, Swift, meat kind of plants and those kind of people. But another fact I think that's real interesting is I'm looking at crude oil is up $1.87 as we speak.
Right.
And I was on a site called AboutSaudiArabia.net a couple of days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a related document in there written by one of the OPEC sheiks, and he was stating in this document that Saudi Arabia has all the oil that we could possibly use, and even makes light that we would have to have a creation of more machines in order to even put their oil in jeopardy.
Yeah, well, you know, that's talk is cheap. The fact of the matter is that in the mid-'80s, when Saudi Arabia started borrowing against their oil reserves, because they're actually in debt right now and have been for some time, they've been
really
living lavishly, living large.
Sure.
When they started, when they went into debt, they suddenly increased their estimate of their reserves by about a third, and with absolutely no science to back it up. And it's now costing $12 to $15 a barrel, as best can be estimated, to pump Saudi oil. The cost of drawing it up, implying that the oil wells are getting down near near
right,
their Hubbard peak. And whereas Iraqi oil costs less than $1.50 a barrel to pump, it bubbles out of the ground. You don't have to suck hard on the straw like you do with Saudi oil. So the Saudis are a less reliable supply of oil. And you know, as a lot of people point that out, Dick Cheney among them, and say, you know, that's part of the reason why it's a useful thing, you know, Dick Cheney here.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves.
There you go. So
I know.
Anyhow, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, bye now.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman with you. 5 minutes before the hour, the new firestorm, as it were, that's erupting in the UK, probably underreported in the United States, as most are. But this, the news story, today's Independent, the one of the major newspapers in Great Britain. Headline, U.S. lied to Britain over use of napalm in Iraq war. A story, American officials lied to British ministers over the use of internationally reviled napalm-type firebombs in Iraq. Yesterday's disclosure led to calls by members of Parliament for a full statement to the Commons and opened ministers to allegations that they had held back the facts until after the general election, this being the Tony Blair's election just a few weeks ago. Despite persistent rumors of injuries among Iraqis consistent with the use of incendiary weapons such as napalm, Adam Ingram, the defense minister, assured Labour MPs in January that U.S. forces had not used a new generation of incendiary weapons, codenamed MK-77, in Iraq. These, by the way, weapons where the MK-77 bomb, an evolution of the napalm used in Vietnam and Korea, carry kerosene-based jet fuel and polystyrene so that, like napalm, the gel sticks to its victims. The bombs lack stabilizing fins, making them far from precise. Okay. Mr. Ingram said 30 MK-77 firebombs were used by the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force in the invasion of Iraq between 31 March and 2 April 2003. Mr. Ingram did not explain why U.S. officials had misled him. U.S. authorities only admitted the use of the weapons after the evidence from reporters had become irrefutable. We are looking really bad, even to our allies right now. What the Bush administration has completely trashed our reputation all over the planet. Scott in San Diego on the line. Hey, Scott, what's up? We got about 30 seconds here left.
Well, good morning, Tom. It's good to talk to you again. 30 seconds is just great. Listen, I'm hearing the war dead in Iraq are actually a lot higher, that they're closer to 7,000 or more because they are not counting men, soldiers who die on the way to the hospital or in the hospital days later after being wounded. The number is much higher, but unfortunately, Tom, I can't find the reference for that.
Yeah, I can't either. And actually, I saw that in one of the reports a few weeks ago that listed, you know, who died and all that sort of thing, one of the people who they listed as having died had died in Germany in the hospital. So I think if they weren't counting them before, they are now.
So, I hope so. I think the war dead's a lot higher. We should really know the true count.
Yeah, but it really doesn't matter. I mean, 1,700 people is a lot of people. If it's even one person who's dead, I'm, you know, as a result of a lie by George Bush, I'm outraged. That you know, one would be one more than happened as a result of Bill Clinton's lies that got him impeached. And here we have 1,700 Americans dead, 20 to 30,000 have lost arms and legs and eyes and in some cases their minds or their ability to mentally function, 100,000 dead Iraqis. The price has been too high, absolutely too high, particularly since Iraq represented no threat to us and had nothing to do with 9/11. See you Monday.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.